This morning we're going to concentrate on the bigger picture and how policymakers and planners can successfully deal with the challenges upon us now and likely to be in the future. And to discuss this, I'm joined by two prominent strategists, Sir Lawrence Freedman and Professor Thomas Christensen. Lawrence is Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. He was former Prime Minister Tony Blair's foreign policy advisor and a member of the Chilcot Inquiry, but we won't be talking to him about that. He's appeared before on Saturday Extra, the last time with the publication of his book on strategy, history in 2013. Thomas Christensen's a Professor of World Politics of Peace and War and Secretary of Director of the China and the World Program at Princeton University. He was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs during the Bush administration. He's also written widely, and we'll have those details on our website. Both gentlemen are in Australia, courtesy of the Coral Bell School's 50th anniversary. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Thank you.
Look, for those really worrying, and I think really worrying at the moment, about this period of extreme volatility, as students of history, do you choose to compare it with any other times of history, just by way of making a bit more sense of it? Sir Lawrence Freedman?
I think it's always dangerous to say this is like, you know, Weimar Germany or the 30s, because it's not. It's very different. The number of states in the international system, the role of the United States, the experiences that we've had in the past, the lessons that we've drawn from them, all make this very different. I think it's always useful to use history to understand how we are where we are, but it's not always very useful to use history to draw exact parallels, because they're never exact and they can be actually quite misleading.
I suppose I was thinking possibly of the turmoil. There's often periods of great turmoil at times of great change, at the end of the Napoleonic War, for instance, at the end of World War II. Just to remind people that this turmoil is not unprecedented, would you agree?
Sure. One thing we have to understand is we're much more aware of events in other places now than we would have been in the past. You can watch horrible events unfolding in France, say, on real time. You can follow an unfolding coup in Turkey on real time and comment on it and try to work out what's going on. So I think we have a greater sense of events and turmoil than in the past, largely because the media is there to keep us all so informed in real time.
Mm. Therefore, I suppose, Professor Christensen, it means drawing the public in a way maybe your discipline hasn't had to do in the past, in some of the dilemmas and the possible solutions.
I think that's right. I think that one of the problems is that we have a heightened awareness of all the problems in the world because we have such global awareness of events. And because there's a 24-hour news cycle now, those events tend to be repeated over and over again for audiences so that they are highly sensitized to an event in France, to an event in Turkey. But if you look at the long stretch of world history, there have always been terrible events, and people haven't been as aware of them. On the other hand, I would say that there's a reason for this, and that is globalization really has linked the world in a way that it never was in the past, so that an event in Turkey really can have serious implications for someone in France and vice versa, in a way that probably wouldn't have been true in the 18th and the 19th centuries. So bad news does have a ripple effect around the world, a destabilizing ripple effect, and it does deserve our attention. I just think it's very difficult for many people to keep things in perspective. World War II was terrible. The Cold War was terrible. It's a good thing that they're both over with. We do face real challenges, but we should not be too spoiled in our analysis of how dire the circumstances of the world of today really are.
Yes, I'm going to come to your specific interest of China in just a moment, but I suppose, Sir Lawrence, these ripples that I think Professor Christensen describes, challenging democracies' choices that they make. You've written very interestingly about some people have almost like a Putin envy because they think that he moves so boldly and leaves the West looking flat-footed by response. But you've got a very interesting reply to that.
Well, the reply is in two ways. First, it's always the case that the democracies can seem flat-footed compared with authoritarian states, frankly, because authoritarian states can act in an authoritarian way. They can take bold moves and catch others by surprise. But that has two problems. First, those bold moves are often not checked, not challenged by advisers, by staffs, because they're scared to do so. So the great advantage of democratic systems in that respect is it's less likely to allow a bad policy through. We make, goodness knows, there are plenty of bad policies, but of that level, they're less likely to go through. And secondly, Putin, it seems to me, though bold, doesn't necessarily think through the consequences of where it's going, so that the problem, which is a general problem for strategy, is not the first move, it's the second and the third move after that. And that's where it seems to me he's fallen short, certainly in Ukraine. I think it's Syria is a slightly different question about his role and impact there. But certainly, as far as Ukraine has gone, I don't think he's achieved what he wanted, though he acted bold. So I think as democracies who are feeling slightly battered at the moment, because democracies do have the habits, as we've just seen in the UK, of producing surprising decisions, but we should have a lot more confidence in our own systems of government and the advantages of open debate and constant challenge.
Indeed, Professor Christensen, would you say that, like an autocratic system like China, that it is challenged when a ruling such as the one that came down, an unambiguously bad ruling for China, are they particularly exposed at a time like this?
I think that the Chinese government has a problem partially of its own making, which is that in the reform era, where communism as a thought process and as a social organizing principle has been jettisoned, and you still have a Chinese Communist Party in charge in Beijing, that they have to come up with other reasons to justify the single party rule of the Chinese Communist Party. And a big justifying reason is nationalism. And when there are rulings like this, this triggers for a lot of Chinese citizens and also for Chinese elites the notion that outside forces are somehow trying to take something away from China that is rightfully its own. And I think that the Chinese government, because of its legitimacy challenges on the home front, often feels like it has to take a very tough position in response to any kind of external pressure. And as you say, the ruling was very much in the favor of the Philippines. And this does pose some real challenges for Beijing and its foreign policy. I also think it could, if rightfully considered.
Well, it does for the West too, doesn't it?
Well, I think if rightfully considered in Beijing, it could also provide some opportunities for them to settle these disputes in peaceful ways. And that remains to be seen how both China and the other disputants and how outside actors like the United States and Japan, the EU, how they address this ruling and how they handle their relations with China during this sensitive period. But I tend to think that rulings like this could provide an opportunity for settlements of disputes. They could also provide an occasion for escalation of tensions, and good diplomats can work with these realities and prevent conflicts that are avoidable, in my opinion.
Yes, you're known very much for your even-handedness and sort of rational analysis of China-US relations, and you write, interestingly, well that's what
that.
I've read.
Can you tell my wife?
I have read this, I have to tell you, because we get very strident analyses here in Australia from the US about China, and Australians who need China so much, if you know what I mean, I think have learned to become a bit sceptical of them. But you write, success requires, this is in terms of China-US, success requires an unusual mix of strength and toughness on the one hand and a willingness to reassure and listen to the Chinese on the other. So what would you be saying to Beijing right now if you had the opportunity?
I would be pointing out to Beijing that the ruling of the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea does nothing to steal away China's sovereignty, China's historic claims to specific features in the South China Sea. All it does is clarify what various features claimed by various actors mean under international law, international laws that China itself has signed on to. So properly viewed, the ruling should not be seen as some kind of massive challenge to China's national honor. And if properly handled on the Chinese side, it could become an opportunity for China to guarantee certain rights and privileges for its citizens in a sea that is nearby China, from which Chinese citizens have benefited in the past, and at the same time provide reassurance to China's neighbors that they will have access to those seas and resources. And my own view of the situation is that what is good for China is not necessarily bad for others, and what is good for others is not necessarily bad for China, and that if the region is stable, all the actors in the region will benefit. And I know from an American perspective that most U.S. leaders, most U.S. analysts do not see the situation in East Asia as a zero-sum game between the United States and China. And if the region were stable, the United States itself would benefit greatly from that outcome.
So, Lawrence, getting to the area of where you have specifically said you feel that we could have done better in the Middle East, that's the West, yet you say that a main strategic priority of the West are its strong alliances, and that, in a way, we have to be conscious of those as a very important strut, a positive strut in our lives. So, I mean, how would you meld both those interests of yours, I suppose, in terms of Syria?
Well, first, I mean, the importance of alliance, which is something that the UK and Australia share, is the international order still depends very much on the role of the United States and what it's prepared to put into it and how others are prepared to support it. And if there is big change going on at the moment, it revolves around the durability of those alliances. And that takes us to the Middle East, because it seems to me that's where, in some ways, the US role was always a bit unclear, a bit less fixed than it was in Europe and Asia Pacific, and where it's now come under the greatest challenge, because Americans wonder why they should put themselves out quite so much to deal with what seems to be a very turbulent region, which hasn't produced a lot of foreign policy successes in recent times. And Syria encapsulates something that I think is very much a problem of our time, which is when awful things are going on in quite a large and complex country, how is it that we can help? What is it that we can do to make it better rather than making it worse? Or is our objective, is it just to contain it in some way? So in Europe, the refugee crisis that's emerged from Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan has caused real upheaval in Europe as well, and could cause more. So we have real interests involved here, more than in some ways the United States, but we're at a bit of a loss once a conflict has reached the stage that Syria has, which is very advanced and very violent, to work out how we address it. So, you know, one of the lessons is that actually if you leave something too long, it doesn't get easier, and that the time when intervention would have been most effective is a few years ago. That's no consolation to the Syrians now. My guess is we're in for quite a long, hard grind, concentrating possibly on ISIS at the moment, working on local ceasefires, trying to see if there's a possibility of a broader political agreement. But it isn't going to be easy, and it isn't going to be quick.
Well, no. And also, that whole notion, as I read while I was away, someone effectively said, I'm paraphrasing, if something isn't solved, it will visit you in your own backyard. Now, that is exactly what is happening with the refugee crisis, is it not? Which, you know, played a major role in Brexit.
It wasn't important. It wasn't the only factor in Brexit, but it was certainly a factor in Brexit. And the Middle East is next door. Terrible things go on in Africa, so in the, say, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which are worse than Syria, and frankly, nobody notices very much. I think it shows, in some extent, one of the problems of alliance is that we have tended to rely on the United States to take the lead to solve these problems for us. And when the United States is less keen, because it isn't so directly involved as we are, the Europeans can find themselves a bit of a loss and floundering around, frankly, trying to work out some sensible responses. We may get there in the end, but not after an awful lot of damage has been done.
Well, look, thank you both very much indeed. Plenty more to talk about, but I'd better let you get back to your conference. So, Sir Lawrence Freedman and Professor Thomas Christensen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And in fact, we'll have details of their various very impressive books on our website. That was part of the Coral Bell School's 50th anniversary.